Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey everyone, welcome to Why Food? This is your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And I'm Ethan Frisch.
If you don't recognize our voices, it's because we're the new co-hosts for this season, season four. Patrick has moved on to some exciting new projects, but we are very, very happy to be here filling some big shoes. I will just do a quick introduction about myself and also let Ethan do the same. I am a professional chef here in New York City. I started my career in management consulting and then went on to pursue my MBA at Columbia before deciding to leave and going back to culinary school. So now I split my time being a chef, doing culinary consulting. I run a pop-up series named Wednesdays and have been exploring fusing food with emerging tech.
And I'm Ethan Frisch. I own a direct trade spice company called Burlap and Barrel. I'm also a former chef as well as a former international aid worker. And I lived in Afghanistan and the Middle East for a while before coming back to New York to start a spice company, working with a lot of the communities that I spent time with as an aid worker.
Today, we're really, really excited to have the founder and CEO of Farm One, Rob Lang, here with us today. Rob, thank you so much for joining us. Rob is the founder and CEO of Farm One. They're one of the amazing indoor farms here in New York. They grow incredible, rare, these microgreens, flowers, everything that you would want inside two locations in downtown Manhattan. Rob.
Hey, great to be with you guys.
Thanks for joining us. So we're going to start the show with your aha moment. You have this incredible company. You came from tech and a translation software company before this. How did you know that this was what you needed to be doing?
Yeah, I was doing very, very different things before. But I think my aha moment was really in a farmer's market in Santa Monica, where I was studying for a month doing some culinary classes. And my friend Sean showed me this herb that I'd never seen before, and he said, hey, try this. This is papalo. And I started to smell this green herb and crushed it up in my fingers and got this amazing, weird, wonderful aroma, which was somewhat like orange peel. There's some citrusy notes in it, some cilantro notes, and then a grassiness when you taste it. And I just thought, oh, this is crazy, because I'm someone who I thought knew a lot about food and was into food, but I've never even seen this thing. And I'm 30-something years old. You know, I think I was 35 or something at the time. And so I was just blown away that something could exist that I hadn't come across before. And so that sort of started the wheels turning in my head. And as a kind of tech guy, I started to look for, you know, a way to maybe grow these kind of things in a city and make this kind of produce a little bit more accessible. And that's how the journey sort of started, just from that taste at the farmer's market.
So indoor farming, vertical farming, is pretty new. A lot of people don't know much about it or how it works. How did you kind of get into that, since you didn't have a background in it, and start learning about it?
Yeah, so I had been living in Japan for 8 years doing something completely different. I was running a software translation company that was a startup. And I feel like, and this is something where maybe my memory is wrong, but I feel like I had seen some news footage of people growing lettuces under LED lights in Japan and these sort of pristine kind of clean room conditions. And so that was in my head, and I kind of thought, oh, maybe I'll research that a little bit. And the more I researched, the more I sort of learned. And I learned that in Japan, for instance, these kind of plant factories had started to crop up in the late sort of 2010s, you know, something like that. Because of a few things, like firstly, the semiconductor industry in Japan had been declining. And so a lot of these kind of clean manufacturing facilities were sort of going into disuse. And the government had started to incentivize people to reuse them. And in addition to that, the price of LED lights had gone down. And so they were becoming more affordable. And then after the Fukushima disaster because of the earthquake in Japan, people started to be really concerned about food safety and radioactive contamination of soil and that kind of thing. And so you'd seen people start to experiment with growing food under LED lights. And that was sort of how I, you know, I sort of started to learn about that stuff. I started to do a lot of research on YouTube. A lot of what I found about indoor growing was about growing marijuana. Because if you go on YouTube and you search for hydroponics, that's what you're going to find. And actually, I learned a lot that way. And there's a lot that we sort of borrow from that industry. But that's how I sort of started to investigate. But really, you know, I don't come from a farming background. My parents, weirdly enough, sort of took over an olive farm about 15 years ago. So they grow olives in Australia in this completely opposite condition to how I farm. You know, they their problems are like kangaroos banging into trees and cockatoos eating olives. I'm not even joking. But really, I had no farming background. And so it was very much from a tech perspective that I kind of viewed it as a sort of problem that I could solve. And that's how I started.
And you had come from another tech company that you'd started. Could you talk a little bit about that transition? It sounds like the companies were very different. So what was the process like?
Yeah, I think the process was, you know, in Japan, starting this crazy company, it's called Gango. And I worked on that for several years. We raised a bunch of money from VCs and we kind of went through this quite typical startup journey, I would say. But part of that startup journey is about working crazy hours and not really looking after yourself. And So towards the end of that time, I really decided I had to kind of reset and really look at the way I was eating because I was getting sick all the time from traveling. I had put on a lot of weight. And so I really sort of transitioned into a much more like whole plant food diet. And that was a big sort of big thing that happened to me in my life. And so what I realized was the next thing I wanted to do was something around food. And I wasn't so sure what it would be. I was pretty confident I didn't have the skills to be a chef like you, Jenny, for instance. But I knew that I was really interested in the food system and that kind of thing. And so that was how it happened. It was sort of as a consequence of being unhealthy through my previous startup that I wanted to do something in food for my next one. So
Has it worked? Are you healthier now than with your last startup?
In many ways, I would say yes. You know, I think that like I have amazing access now to fresh food.
Yes.
I also have amazing access to quite fancy restaurants as well. So, you know, there's ups and downs. But yeah, definitely it's great to be around food. And I'm really sort of excited to be in this world.
Given your tech background, how was being able to slowly ease out of your first company, letting go, it's still going now and very viable, but also approaching food from a tech perspective, as you said, solving this problem from that perspective. And can you tell us a little bit more about like Farm One software and such?
Yeah, so leaving my previous company was actually quite a painful experience. And there's certain things I can talk about and others that I can't. But, you know, effectively, the company was grown in Japan and had a lot of opportunity to expand in other countries. But, you know, the choice was made to expand in Japan, which sort of didn't include me in many ways. So, you know, it was very painful to leave that company. It was also very, very good for me. And I was very, very lucky to be able to leave and then go and do a new thing. So, you know, so I said farewell to that. And I had a lot of time to kind of, you know, just think and go like, oh my God, what am I going to do next? You know, which I think is like an amazing luxury. And I had the opportunity to travel and try new things. And so, you know, starting something like Farm One, you know, I just come at things from a tech background. And so I tend to, you know, look at certain things as maybe an engineering problem or a software problem. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in constructing Farm One, you know, we use hydroponics, which if many people have not heard of it, it means growing plants in a water-based nutrient solution instead of soil. And that's a technique that's been around in various forms for about 80, 90 years, but really has come to the fore in the past maybe 10, 20 years, specifically because a lot of people growing marijuana, but also a lot of desire to grow more things indoors. And it's a way of growing that you can do, in many different ways, but we choose to do it using a lot of recycled plant-based nutrients, a lot of biodigested plant material. There's some fish waste, there's some bat waste in there as well. But it's actually a very sort of organic way of doing hydroponics, which I think has sometimes instead had this kind of chemical reputation. I think some people have looked at hydroponics as something where you maybe don't get the most amazing tasting produce. So when I started Farm One, I was very determined if I was going to grow these weird and wonderful plants, I wanted them to taste as good as they could. And so I really, you know, put a lot of effort in, and the first person I hired, David, our head horticulturist, has put a lot of effort into growing plants through this slightly more natural way of doing hydroponics. And then the other piece to our sort of tech equation is, you know, the lights that we use. We use these LED lights that are specifically designed for horticulture. They give the plants effectively like a great summer's day every day. So it's sort of like this cushy kind of setup for the plants.
Vacation.
Yeah, exactly. Vacation every day. Although, you know, we do some things to stress the plants as well. So, you know, we have various bits of wind in the room. You've seen all the fans, for instance, blowing the leaves around. We also have, you know, beneficial insects that are there to control the bad insects. And so there's a lot of insect kind of activity in the room as well, as opposed to using pesticides. And this can help the plants build up, you know, more of a terpene defense, which is a lot of the smells and the aromas that you're getting off plants. And so we've tried to do something where it is a very tech-driven approach, but it creates a lot of the sort of ecosystem advantages for plants to taste good. And then I would say the last piece of it is that everything we grow is grown to order for chefs, which creates this sort of crazy Tetris management challenge that we solve through software. And so, you know, we may have a batch that is due to be delivered in 2 weeks' time to, I don't know, restaurant Danielle or something. And we know that we have to plant that batch on a certain day, and it has to go in a certain space, and it has to be under a certain type of lighting with certain nutrients. And so the software that we've developed really allows us to manage the farm that way. And it kind of tells us where to put things, and it tells us when things need to be moved and under what situation. And so that software has really allowed us to grow, you know, at any one time, we're growing about 200 different varieties in our farm. And then maybe there's like 600 different batches going on. So keeping track of that with a paper and pencil would be absurd. You know, even doing it on like a spreadsheet would drive you crazy. So the software sort of helps us to do that. So it's a very tech-driven approach to that particular problem.
Could you describe the farm for us? What does it look like? What does it smell like when you walk in? Because it's in a basement in Tribeca, which is not generally the environment you associate with a farm. But it has such a... I've been there. I was there recently, and it has such a... It feels like stepping out of New York City when you walk through that door. So can you just tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole situation is kind of crazy because the building we're in, you know, you walk in the front door, there's a 2 Michelin star restaurant there called Aterra, which is serving some of the best food we think in the country. And then just below that is a vet, you know, so you have to walk past the vet to go down the hallway to us. And then our farm is across the hallway from the kitchen for Aterra. So you've got chefs going in and out all the time. There's a private dining room there. It's kind of crazy. And then you kind of peek through and you see these different colored lights. So there's some pinkish lights, there's some greenish lights. And you'll see, you know, maybe through that little window from the hallway, you'll see some basil flowers and you'll see some dianthus and some nepotella. All arranged on these vertical, you've got a vertical stack of horizontal growth kind of levels. And we use a rolling rack system that allows us, you might have seen these things in libraries and storage rooms where you only have to have one aisle open at a time, and we do that to maximize space. And so you go into that room, and as you said, it's kind of like this crazy oasis in the middle of a concrete jungle. And then, you know, on one shelf, you might have one plant. Next to it, you have some anise hyssop, and then below that, you've got some bronze fennel, and there's flowers all over the place. And it's sort of this crazy fun place to be. And, you know, it's a mixture of it being a very hardworking environment. Our people, you know, work very hard, and it's very, very busy. But it's also like somewhat serene, and, you know, tasting some of these things is incredibly sort of evocative and almost emotional, you know? And so we have people come into our farm who maybe taste something that they don't even know the name of, but they say, "Oh, I remember finding this in the field when I was a kid, you know, in Germany or something." And so it's sort of this amazing library of tastes and flavors. And And that's exciting. Yeah, it's like a it's like an Eden underneath the concrete jungle.
Your current location at Atera is your second location.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about when you first started? You have a location over at the Institute of Culinary Education as well. And just like getting into that space, starting small, your philosophy behind how to, you know, get your yourselves into the space first.
Yeah, so I think, you know, probably quite a few people listening have either got small businesses in food or thinking about it. And it's sort of a very daunting thing of like, you know, you can do all the planning you like, right? But there's a point when you go like, oh, actually, now I'm doing it. Like, now I'm renting the space, or now I'm building this thing. And so for us, you know, I really wanted to find a space at the beginning for FarmWell where we could experiment on a very small scale. I knew that I didn't have the money or the confidence to build something that was like a 100,000 square foot facility or something. So we were looking for space in Manhattan, and we were so lucky that David, the first person I hired, was actually consulting with ICE to build and start working on a little farm inside their facility inside Brookfield Place in downtown Manhattan. So they had built this beautiful 74,000 square foot new culinary school just across the street from the World Trade Center Memorial site. And they had decided to put a little room in there, which is not very big. It's about 300 square foot. But they had a little space, and they didn't really have anyone to run it. And so they had equipment there that was not really being used. And so we saw it as this amazing opportunity to come in, install a bunch more equipment, and really get this room going as a Farm One operation. And that's what we did. And you know, I look back at some of the other spaces that I had considered for Farm One, and I'm not kidding, one of them was underneath a discount clothing store in the financial district. Yeah, I mean, it was not a good situation. And so what we were able to do with ICE is come in and really help them, you know, have something that's an amazing draw for their students and events that they do, but also give us amazing access to, you know, to them. And and, you know, it's crazy because, like, across the hallway we have Michael Lisconis in his chocolate lab, who's this three Michelin star chef who was at Le Bernardin, and we have amazing events. We have Bill Telepan, who comes in and works with us. So we've been incredibly lucky there. And I think I'm just so glad, you know, in starting this business that I held out a little bit for that kind of thing, because it's been an amazing advantage for us, yeah.
And so as an entrepreneur starting a business, how do you know? How do you know when to pull the trigger and when to wait for a better opportunity?
I have no answer for that. But I think that, you know, I'm someone who tends to, I do a lot of research, but then when I've started to make a decision, that decision is pretty firm, you know? But I try to be very, very confident in decisions by, you know, exhaustively researching thing, trying to become a mini expert in something before I make a decision. So, so yeah, but I think that, you know, the second sort of big decision for us, I guess, was like when Atera, you know, told us there was some space in their building, was deciding to take that leap. And so, you know, we installed the farm at ICE in April 2016. Again, that was a prototype. What we wanted to figure out there was we wanted to figure out some really key things, like, can we grow interesting things that taste damn good, you know? And if that hadn't, if we weren't able to do that, like, forget the rest. Like, it's there's no point doing it. But pretty quickly, we were confident that we had, you know, something really exciting. And I think, you know, the first customer we actually had was Restaurant Danielle, selling them some Nepotella flowers. Nepotella is a Tuscan herb which produces these beautiful, tiny, pink, delicate flowers. And they were really excited about that product. And so we knew, okay, if we can get a two Michelin star restaurant as our first customer, then I think we've got something pretty interesting here. And then, you know, the next question was, can we get the price point that we need? You know, there's a certain price point that we need to operate the farm. And we started to get that. And we were like, okay, this is interesting. And then we sold out the space on the farm. And so we were like, all right, there's something here. And so when Atera said to us, hey, we've got this space in our building, you know, I think we were confident enough to say, okay, yeah, it is time to expand this business. And I am confident enough to, you know, try and pull together some money from friends and family and try to, you know, just do this and that to make it work. And so, yeah, it is kind of scary to make those decisions, but I, you know, I'm very, very confident that we made the right decisions as well.
I mean, starting with Restaurant Danielle is a pretty amazing first customer. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, your last company you were also selling into, so it was a B2B company, and Farm One is B2B as well, but it's different kinds of customers, and just starting that sales process.
Yeah, so I learned a lot about sales in my previous company, and I started out my career as a designer and a developer, and I was someone who didn't really respect sales. And like, I think a lot of people are in this position where, if you're like a maker, you don't necessarily sort of understand. And so you see salespeople as these kind of sleazy, like hard, pushy, And I learned a lot at my previous company that there's a real craft to sales, and good salespeople are worth their weight in gold, and good salespeople are incredibly intelligent and articulate and well-prepared and knowledgeable, and building up a competent sales team is an amazing skill. And so, our experience at Gengo was really selling to larger enterprise organizations. So we were selling to TripAdvisor or eBay or Amazon, or even, in Japan, selling to like Mitsui, or selling to like Toshiba or something, which is, I don't wish that on anyone, by the way, because even in the US, for instance, like you're doing 6-7 PowerPoint presentations to these people, you're trying to gather all these stakeholders and you're doing all that, and that can be rewarding financially, but it can be a little bit soul destroying. So moving to this world, selling to chefs, the opposite is true. Most chefs don't even have time to reply to an email. So let alone, I can't even imagine Chef looking at a PowerPoint presentation. It's just insane, right? So, what we realized pretty fast was, okay, well, we just bring our product to the chef. That's how you do it. It's obvious, right? But I think that the sort of cool thing about that is that, and I don't want to encourage everyone to knock on the door of the kitchen of 11 Madison Park just on their lunch hour just for fun. But, there are kitchens in New York which have amazing reputations, but you can get in the door of that kitchen. If you have something that's tasty and good quality, chefs will hear you out. They're not going to invite you back if it turns out to be bad. But if you've got something really good, you can get in touch with that decision maker pretty fast. And that's sort of unique in the world. People pay thousands of dollars to go to trade shows to maybe get the chance of getting the business card of the person who knows. Whereas in this world, you can get in touch with the right people if you've got something good. But you've really got to have something amazing, because on the flip side, chefs will make that decision in the moment. You make that decision with your nose and with your tongue. And if it ain't good, then it's not going to happen. So it's a very different experience, but I like it because there's a visceral reaction when someone tastes something amazing. You guys both know this, when you introduce something to someone and it's a surprising taste, or it's something new, or it's just perfectly balanced, it's an amazing positive reaction. And that's a nice way to work. And I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I think I, with my company, had a similar sort of realization with sales, especially early on, picking a neighborhood and going with a backpack full of spices, literally walking into restaurants totally cold and saying, I want the chef to taste this. And my fair share of chefs laughing in my face, or I don't have time, or who the hell are you, or what, what do you actually want from me? But that moment of a new taste, a new experience, or something that reminds them of something they tasted as a kid or haven't been able to find is pretty incredible as a small business owner, as an entrepreneur, to get that kind of validation so immediately and so emotionally is pretty incredible.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think that, one of the nice things as a follow-up to that is generally, with restaurant customers, if they start buying from you, you can generally get a regular sale. And so we're lucky enough to have quite a stable customer base, which is really good. And it allows us to build our business. It's not based on them subscribing to some online platform or something. It's based on them needing this thing every week for their restaurant. And that's great.
And what's the next step for that? How are you engaging with the restaurant's customers? What do they know about you and your business, and what do you know about them?
Yeah, it really depends. I think that there are some high-end restaurants where the menu is the menu, and while the server may be happy to talk about it, it's not so much about introducing purveyors. It's more about the creation of the chef, and that's totally fine. Mm-hmm. We're happy to support that. But there's other places where they really, really do talk about their sourcing. And obviously at Aterra, that's a very easy conversation for them to have, because they're right downstairs, and they treat some customers by taking them down to the farm, which is really special. But then we work with a lot more accessible places as well. So, we work with Pizza Loves Emily, for instance, and they're they're great to us on Instagram, always shout out for us, and they're a great customer. So it can be pretty casual like that as well. But, generally, I think the story for a restaurant to work with us is great, right? And, you know, if someone asks, oh, where did this flower come from? And they can say, oh, it's, you know, a mile away down in Tribeca. Yeah. Like, that's pretty great. And so we like being part of that. And I think it's fun for everyone.
Yeah. All right, great. We're going to take a quick break and come back in a couple of minutes to talk about some bigger questions around urban farming and yeah, I mean, the context that you're working in. Thanks.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious, stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Satori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country.
And we're back. I'm Ethan Frisch.
I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we're here with Rob Lang of Farm One. They're a vertical farm in Tribeca in Manhattan. And we're talking about urban farming and incredible rare flowers and plants that grow in a basement in Tribeca, which is such a strange place for them to grow, but makes perfect sense.
Yeah, Rob, can you tell us a little bit about these varieties that you have? How did you find that they were the right ones to grow? There's some really rare, interesting stuff that I think Ethan and I have both tasted and been pretty blown away by. And also making sure that when you do grow something, you have, you know, that someone will be buying it.
Yeah, so from the very beginning, you know, I was excited about growing things that you just definitely wouldn't find in a grocery store and probably wouldn't even find in the farmer's market. And so, you know, at the beginning we grew maybe 10 different varieties that we had selected. And I think one of them was Nepotella, as I mentioned, that Tuscan herb. One of them was like red shiso, for instance, the Japanese leaf. And, you know, we knew that those were interesting, but from the very beginning, we wanted to be really chef driven. And so we would ask chefs who came into the farm or that we brought samples to, hey, what do you really want to get that you can't get? Mm-hmm. And so that's how we've really built up our range of products. And now over the past 2 years, we've grown close to 600 different things, which is crazy. It's sort of a rate of six different varieties every week. And that's based on chefs saying, hey, you know, in Denmark, I used to be able to get this. Or back in Mexico, we, you know, use epazote or something. And it's really been driven by that. And I think, you know, that's if you can do that, that's an amazing way to build a product range because you know that people want it and you know that people are excited about it. And, you know, the way that we actually grow for our customers is pretty much all to order. And so a chef will tell us, okay, we want a delivery of this every week. And so we'll grow those batches specifically for that chef. You know, going into this, I was kind of scared of having a farm and not knowing who my customer was going to be for the product that I grow. And I had had a pretty scary conversation with someone who had ended up in exactly that situation where he had built a pretty big farm. And guess what? He didn't have a customer for his product. And so he was throwing away thousands of pounds of basil every month. And mm-hmm. that's a pretty sad place to be. So, you know, I wanted to look at it a different way. And our initial, you know, offering to chefs was, oh, hey, we'll rent you space on the farm. Like, oh, you can have 16 square feet and you can grow whatever you like. And, you know, that sort of sounds nice in theory, but if you're a chef in a busy kitchen, you don't really want to think that way. You want to know that you're going to get
you know, your two clamshells of bachelor button flowers every week on a Wednesday or something.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't have time to go like, okay, shall I plant this week? You know, it doesn't work. So, yeah, we learned pretty quickly on that. But the nice thing that we kept was we were able to actually sell up front and, you know, get people to tell us what they wanted to have. And we would grow it for them. And we, you know, reorganized the whole farm that way now. So everything that we grow is, you know, allocated to a chef. And that's pretty great because it means that we're not growing product that we have to rush out and find buyers for. And it gives us much more predictable revenue. You know, it requires like a lot more, as I said, on that software side for us to be able to manage. But we can do it. And it's a good way of doing it that we're pretty happy with.
And coming into an agricultural business from a tech perspective, did you have a passion for agriculture before? Was there something pulling you towards farming or did you stumble into this another way?
Well, I would say if you'd asked me 5 years ago, like, would I be running a farm? I would have thought you were crazy. Like, I would have just, because, you know, part of my existence has been about design and programming and also living in Japan in a city. You know, everything is so precise and orderly. It's the opposite of farming, you know? Yep. So really farming and getting into farming like this, specifically urban farming, vertical farming, for me, the route in has been food. It's been the end product. And we, you know, at Farm One, we always talk about that chain from seed to harvest to the plate, right? And we're a part of that flow. And, you know, the way we work in our operations is pretty close to a restaurant kitchen. We use a lot of restaurant type equipment. You know, you'll see like a lot of hotel pans around and you'll see a lot of these commercial dishwashers and that kind of thing. And we're across the hallway from a kitchen. And so I would say our angle on farming is very much like a restaurant as opposed to coming in from the soil. And, you know, I think that's quite different to a lot of other people who've got into urban farming, vertical farming. It's becoming quite a hot sort of space. There's a lot of interest in it from the sustainability angle, that kind of thing. But I have to say my route in has always been growing ingredients and taste and flavor and excitement that way.
Can you talk a little bit about as an indoor and vertical farming has taken off, balancing like the quality perspective in terms versus like the volume perspective?
Yeah, so you know, as I said at the beginning, like we've really been pretty determined to use these plant-based and organic nutrients, for instance, in our growing methods, and we maintain this kind of ecosystem of beneficial insects rather than using pesticides. So there's quite a few choices that we've made in terms of taste over volume. And also just in terms of the farms that we build. You know, the farm in Tribeca is still a tiny farm. It's like 1,200 square foot. And, you know, I was asked by my insurer, you know, they pass you around and they put you in touch with the person who insures farms. And they're like, well, how many acres is your farm? Yeah. And I think it's 0.01 acres or something. So, you know, we have tiny farms. But, you know, our method for growing, the way we want to grow as a business is to have more farms in more cities and kind of replicate this model. Because, you know, we are serving a high-end clientele. We're not serving a huge mass market. But we do think that market exists in many other cities. So we're making decisions more normally about quality versus volume. And there's plenty of other people who want to do vertical farming for the mass market, for growing leafy greens for grocery stores, and that's fine. But really what we're trying to do is something that's more about being special and more about taste.
And there's been a significant discussion around urban farming and vertical farming in particular as a solution to issues of food distribution, food deserts, lack of fresh produce, lack of nutritionally dense foods. Do you feel like what you're doing coincides with that or is in opposition to that? Where do you find the balance between vertical farming as a social good versus vertical farming as a way to create a very specialty product?
Yeah, so certainly we're in a position right now where we're serving like the 1%, I would say. You know, we're serving restaurants in Manhattan. And we've kind of gone that path partly because we're trying to grow really interesting things, and the chefs that tend to buy that and have the budget for it, you know, do tend to be running quite expensive restaurants. Mm-hmm. But also because we're really at the beginning of this whole thing. So if you look at, you know, the price of LEDs, it does sort of go down by half, like roughly every 4 years. And so the technology we're buying now would have been completely ridiculously unaffordable 5 years ago. And now it's sort of in the range where we can buy it. But, you know, look 10 years out, 15 years out, people are going to start to be able to buy this stuff for a price that starts to be affordable. And so, you know, just as Tesla like started with that, like, Roadster, which was the sort of fancy one,
yes.
You know, starting to do more approachable, accessible cars. And I think you'll see the same thing sort of happening with vertical farming. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm really excited about is that we're able to develop some of the practices now around farming in small spaces and underused spaces in cities. We're sort of figuring out some of these things through software, through process, through tech. And these are maybe things that other people can take advantage of and do similar things, you know, in 5-10 years time with much more accessible produce. And mm-hmm. So I'm really excited about the idea that, you know, there are thousands and thousands of unused basements in New York City and Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, like, you know, and we will see people build farms in those places. Mm-hmm. And that solves so many problems and it creates so much cool stuff because, you know, yes, like a food desert, for instance, like if it's a place where people can't get hold of fresh produce, instead of shipping that produce in, we can start growing it in these communities. And also, like, we can grow kind of whatever we want. And that, I think, is something that makes me even more excited because New York City is, you know, I'm an immigrant myself. I'm not a very exciting immigrant, but I'm an immigrant, you know, but like, New York City is made out of immigration and it's made out of people coming from countries which have a very, very diverse culinary tradition. And it's not cool if we all expect everyone to just eat lettuce and tomatoes. It's what is cool is if we can build farms across this city and people can grow the kind of produce that they used to be able to get back home or the mm-hmm. produce that their grandmother remembers getting. And, you know, so like we can as easily, and we do, like we grow Vietnamese mint and we grow epazote and we grow papalo and we grow all these things that like you wouldn't see in a grocery store because the grocery store is kind of in this very fixed, rigid distribution chain. Whereas having urban farms all over cities in, you know, in a decade's time will allow different communities to grow whatever they want. And I just think that's super exciting. And I think that goes beyond problem solving and it becomes like actually reconnecting people with food and making it possible to have a diverse food culture again. And that's so exciting to me.
That sounds like an upcoming TED Talk that you should be doing.
Love to. Great. Let's do it.
We have a lot of listeners who are interested in starting their own businesses or in the process of starting their own businesses. Do you have any advice for them as a twice, maybe more, twice entrepreneur yourself? What lessons have you learned that our listeners can benefit from?
Yeah, I feel like I've learned way too many lessons and I wish I hadn't had to learn quite as many. But I think like, you know, for me, I've started businesses because there's some idea I just couldn't get out of my head and I needed to do it, you know? And I've been lucky enough, I feel like, to choose ideas where they're very deep and the more you go into them, there's more to discover. Like the translation thing, it might sound not that exciting and maybe it's kind of geeky, but the more you look into it, the more it's like you solve this problem. Oh, there's two other things to solve. Mm-hmm. Like, and with the vertical farming, it's the same kind of thing. It's like, oh, we can grow this now, but actually I know a lot more about it now. Maybe we could make it taste better. And then maybe there's this pest that comes in and eats our thing and we have to figure out how to kill the pest. And, you know, and it's like, I like those kind of really exciting, interesting things. And probably those choices have not made me make as much money as I probably could have made, but they've been exciting to me and they've been compelling and they're things that like I can think about all day, every day. And I feel like if you start a business, like, well, personally, I want a business like that where I'm like, there's never going to be anything. I'm never going to stop thinking about things in this business, you know? And then, you know, personally, like I do work really hard on what I do, but I try to, you know, bring together a team of people who I just really enjoy being with, you know, and having people in my company who are interesting and just fun people. And because if you think about it, this is how you spend most of your life.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't spend most of your life actually with your spouse. Like, you spend it with, you know, the person who sits next to you at work. And so let's make that a great team of people that you want to hang out with. And you know, who knows? Like, even if the company fails, like, at least you've had some great experiences and met some great people. So those are two pieces of advice. But, hey, yeah, I've made many, many mistakes as well. Yeah.
What do you see happening in the future for indoor farming, vertical farming? You mentioned a little bit about accessibility, but also before we talked a little bit about organic and that the understanding, changing understanding of that labeling. Like, where do you see that movement going?
Yeah, so, you know, our food system and agriculture is a huge topic, right? And I think that vertical farming, indoor farming, there's a lot of proponents of that movement. You know, people like it because it's like a very clean way of growing in terms of you can control, you don't have to use pesticides, you can be very close to the consumer so you can reduce food miles. There are exciting things about that. I think that in terms of the whole ecosystem of food, it's a small part. And so when we talk about solving food problems, I wouldn't want to say that it's going to solve every single problem. But yeah, it's a really exciting opportunity. And I think that, you know, other companies that people might want to check out is, for instance, like AeroFarms, Bowery. There's a big company called Plenty. Those guys are kind of doing this on a very, very big scale. But I think that, you know, it does also pose some new questions, right? And the organic label, for instance, you know, 10 years ago, maybe people were sort of very confident about what that meant. You know, mostly meant soil-based farming. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot in the organic heritage about soil maintenance, and that can be something that takes, you know, years and years and decades. And so, you know, someone coming into this as a new hydroponic farmer, I think at the beginning, my opinions about labeling were maybe different to as they are now. And, you know, I think at the beginning, I would have wanted that organic label to apply to my produce. Mm-hmm. But now, actually, I don't think it's really appropriate. I think that, you know, a lot of the things that we're doing at Farm One are actually over and above the organic standard. You know, we don't use any pesticides at all. We use only beneficial insects. You know, there's certain things that we do in terms of just delivering to the customer. Like, we're so close to the customer that there's zero food miles. You know, the packaging we use is either compostable or reused. And so there's various parts of our farming practice that I don't think are covered by a simple label. Yep. And I think that applies to like a lot of new urban farmers nowadays. Like, people are just doing interesting new things that go over and above what traditional labels were covering. And so I think just what you'll find is we're going to see new kinds of labels and it's going to evolve. And I think that consumer, you know, there's only so many labels consumers can really put up with. But I think that, you know, we want to have a sort of, we're going to need some greater specificity. And we're going to need ways to sort of cover the practices that we do and other new vertical farmers are doing.
I think the label of sustainability has been like a really hot topic now. Has your view on that changed before and after?
I mean, sustain, again, it's like this huge thing. And I think what I would say that a lot of vertical farmers and hydroponic farmers have been guilty of is overstating the sustainability benefits of our practice. You know, for instance, in hydroponics, often you're using a lot less water than a traditional farm. It can be like 90 to 95% less.
Wow.
But, you know, there's other things going on, right? Like, we're building like plastic trays and we have LED lights and, you know, we use electricity. And I think we've got to be conscious of that as well. And so I tend to try to be realistic about it. Like, for certain types of crops, vertical farming is great. And it probably is a much more sustainable way of growing than shipping something in from Mexico. Mm-hmm. But for other kind of crops, it's not really realistic. And I think that as we build bigger and bigger vertical farms, we've got to look at, okay, what's the real impact there?
Yep.
You know, is this a good practice? And we just got to be smart about it. But I think that the great thing is there's huge amounts of innovation right now going on in agriculture, you know, not just indoor agriculture, also outdoors and, you know, even things like drones helping farmers make farms more efficient,
yeah,
things like that. So there's a lot of innovation going on and I'm really excited about the next 10, 20 years.
I saw some pretty crazy drone action when I was spending some time in a vineyard last year. Like, they will tell you how all the harvests are doing down to the specific plot,
yeah,
when to go pick the grapes, everything. It was pretty crazy.
Wow. So just as we finish, you're in the middle of a crowdfunding campaign, is that right?
That is right.
Tell us more.
Yeah.
Well, so we're doing something called a regulation crowdfunding campaign. That's an equity crowdfunding. So it's not, you know, like Kickstarter, you'll get like a product or something. With this kind of crowdfunding, you get a piece of the company, Farm One. And we are doing this on a platform called Start Engine. If you visit farm.one/invest, it'll take you to the page. And really, you can see all the terms on there, but it gives you a chance to own a piece of the company. And the money that we're raising through the crowdfunding is really for us to both develop our software further. So as I said, software is a huge component of the company, but also help us to build future farms. And so we're ready pretty soon to build another farm, either in New York City or another food-centric city in the U.S. that maybe has a harsh climate, and you can think of like a few of those, I guess. But yeah, it'll give us the chance to do that, which is really exciting. And yeah, the plan is to have multiple Farm Ones around the U.S. and eventually around the world in a few years' time, which I'm excited about.
We have a question in from Instagram about if you are A, hiring, or B, if not hiring, how to get involved at Farm One and learn more.
Yeah, I guess right now, as of this minute, we are B, not hiring. But we often do, and you know, particularly one of the roles that we hire for often is our farm hand role. This is people who work on the farm and actually harvest produce. It's a tough job, but it's actually a lot of fun. But also, there are a couple of ways you can get involved. There are classes that we do regularly, normally every couple of weeks, and those will teach you how to grow hydroponically. You don't need any background; like you can be a complete novice. It'll teach you how to go from seed to harvest with hydroponics. And then we also have a program called Lend a Hand, which is a way to come in and just spend some time on the farm, maybe help us plant some seeds, maybe help us transplant some products. So there's a couple of ways to get involved. And then over time, yeah, maybe we will be hiring. But right now, that's it. Yeah.
And checking out the crowdfunding page also is a way
absolutely
to get involved.
Very much get involved. Yeah, yeah. It's a slightly more expensive way of getting involved. But yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, you never know. Great, Rob. Thank you so much. This was fascinating, and we're really glad you were able to join us today.
Yeah, again, can you tell us one more time how to find you online and how to support you?
Absolutely. So we're Farm One, which is F-A-R-M for mother .O-N-E, and that's our URL as well. It's not farmone.com, or it's just farm.one. We're the same on Instagram, and that's probably the best place to find us if it's not on the web. Yeah.
Great. And we'll post some links on the YFood podcast page as well, and on our Instagram. So
yes,
check out YFood on Instagram as well. Yeah.
One last thing I always forget to say, but you can tour the farm. Like you can tour
yes,
the farm.
Go
yeah,
tour
yeah
the farm.
You can tour the farm. So come, go to our website and you can book a tour. It's $50. You get a glass of Prosecco and you get a gift box, and it's a cool way to experience like dozens of new herbs. And it's a fun date night activity, I got to say. Yeah.
Perfect. A romantic endeavor. Well, thank you all for listening today. If you have questions, things that you want to hear more of, people that you want to see on the show, please email us. We're at yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you, Rob, again for joining us. And please tune in next week as we talk about street vendors.
Yeah, with Matt Shapiro from the Street Vendors Project. He'll be our guest next week. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.